From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour will be made, or possibly won't be made, in Albany before the end of June. We're talking about climate change this hour, and specifically, we're asking if the government has any power to slow it down or mitigate its effects through policy. Turns out the New York State Legislature is considering a handful of bills aimed at climate change action in various ways. Tonight, the League of Women Voters is hosting a free public forum to explain what the bills are. We'll also talk about federal legislation and ideas there. We'll examine what's out there, what might work. This hour, a preview of sorts, and a look at battling climate change through new legislation. Let me welcome my guests for the hour who will be there tonight. And it starts with Catherine Smith, who's the first vice president of the League of Women Voters Rochester Metro Area. Great to have you back here, Catherine. Hello.
Thank you.
Oh, you've got to pull that microphone closer to you. Oh, she's such a veteran of this studio. It's amazing. Right up and close, everybody. Nice and comfortable. Sue Hugh Smith is here. She's an environmental educator, and she's with the Rochester People's Climate Coalition. She's going to be discussing one of the pieces of legislation on the state level, though I suspect, if I know Sue, she'll have some things to say about all of these, and it's nice to see you back here,
Nice to see you, too, Evan.
Barbara Grosch is here, a member of the League of Women Voters Rochester Metro Area, and with Mothers Out Front, who's going to be talking about a bill related to financial surety for major facilities, vessels, and railroads. So Barbara will be talking about that. Nice to have you.
Thank you.
Carol Camp is here, a member of the Citizens Climate Lobby, and she is going to be talking about, well, I think a carbon tax. We'll talk about it on the state level. I think it's also important to talk about what your group wants to see maybe on the federal level, so plenty to talk about with you. Nice to see you here.
Good. Thank you.
All right. Well, I want to start with this, Catherine. Tonight, 7 o'clock, Brighton Town Hall. The public can come there. And why now? Why did you decide, why did the League of Women Voters decide we need this forum now?
Okay. We do educational forums 6 times a year, and we've follow suggestions and recommendations of our members. So we had a group of League members here in the Rochester metro area that have been very interested in the issues of climate change. We worked very closely with several coalitions here in Rochester on the fracking issue for many years. And a lot of these bills that we're going to be talking about tonight are sort of issues that came forth while that larger issue of the fracking it brought to the attention of our members.
Sure. A couple of weeks ago, we had economist Kent Gardner on the program, and Kent said, look, almost every economist he knows, no matter their political leanings, thinks that a carbon tax is probably a good idea in some form, whether it's just making sure there's a baseline lowest price we pay at the gas pump. He thinks it should be $4 a gallon as a baseline, maybe $3 a gallon. And he does say it's easier to do that when prices are high. When we're paying $1.89, and someone says, well, we're going to make sure the floor is $4. I understand that public might balk a little bit. But here we are. Prices are low. Oil prices are low. Gas prices are low. And, Carol, a lot of people are celebrating that. How do you feel about what you see in terms of gas prices, oil prices?
Well, really not too good, because we already, before, were not adding in the cost of carbon to the gas prices. And now it's even less. So we're polluting even more easily without paying for it.
Sue Hugh Smith, are you celebrating low gas prices?
No, not at all. all the evidence shows that as fuel price drops, consumption tends to increase, which is definitely not going to be helping us solve climate change.
But you're someone who's an educator. So you educate on environmental issues, and you also advocate for different policies. And as Kent said on this program, you know, you can talk about a carbon tax on a state level, a federal level, and we're about to get into that. Mm-hmm. He was calling for kind of a floor for gas prices. A couple days after he was on this program, President Obama came out and talked about a kind of an oil, a new oil tax, or a new fee on barrels of oil, because the cost is so low. It doesn't look like it's going up in a long time. And yet Kent says, politically, those are just non-starters. They go nowhere. Mm-hmm. You believe that?
Well, I think so long as we continue to accept that as the answer, then we won't get any change. And so all of us have to start changing the language around this issue. You know, it is in our best interest to start shifting away from fossil fuel use. And a great tool we have to influence public behavior is cost. So I think we just can't accept that as the answer.
Okay, well, then what's the language then? And you know, Carol, I know this is one of the big issues that, in so many ways, that you are going to be talking about tonight, and we can talk about a state carbon tax or whatever it is. But what's the language that you think is effective if the public is going to accept a change in how we pay for gas, pay for oil, what our expectations are? Because right now, what it sounds like is big tax, pay more, pay twice as much. I'm excited because this summer's road trip is going to be a lot less expensive. That's what people are thinking. What's the language that starts to change their mind on this issue?
Well, the Citizens Climate Lobby's proposal gives all the money back to all households equally. So we'll have enough money to compensate for these rises. So individuals won't be hurt by this. Whereas the state one is going to give it to the poorest people.
All right, so hold on. So we're talking about two separate things here.
Mm-hmm.
State legislation,
mm-hmm.
federal. Can we do the state first?
Sure.
All right. So the proposal on the line with New York State, as I understand it, and please feel free to correct, the actual bill is A8372. It's a bill proposing a carbon tax in New York State, yes?
Mm-hmm.
It would do what?
It would have the goal of reducing carbon dioxide emissions by 80% of 1990 levels by 2050. And it would charge a $35 tax per ton on carbon, and it would raise it by $15 every year until it got up to $185 per carbon.
Okay, but in terms of what we pay, because we're talking a tax per ton, et cetera, most people are not consuming carbon in a way that thinks about that. So they would see, most people would see this played out where?
Well, they would see it played out eventually in their bills for fuel, but because it's going to be slow and gradual, mm-hmm. it won't be overwhelming, and that's the important part of any of these things. It's got to be slow and gradual.
All right, so a state carbon tax, mm-hmm. slow and gradual, you do think that's a good approach as mm-hmm. opposed to something dramatic right away?
Right.
Okay. But when it comes to a federal idea, that, how does it differ from what New York State is considering?
Well, New York State is considering a tax a tax discount.
Mm-hmm.
So the consumer doesn't get any money. They just pay less taxes at the end of the year. Where the federal law will give you a monthly fee of $48 beginning at the first year for family of four. And so you'll have monthly money to pay your bills as they rise. Plus, you'll have money to start to invest, and maybe I could afford an electric car, or maybe I could have somebody come in and blow insulation in. Now that I have a monthly income, in order to pay any kind of loan I would take out to do that.
All right. So in New York State, the carbon tax would go into effect. It'd be a gradual rise in the cost of carbon. So even though we'd be paying more for carbon-based services, for fuel, et cetera, there would be a tax discount.
Right.
Whereas on the federal level, we'd be paying more for energy. But we'd be getting, as you said, a family of four, $48 a month, essentially, to help pay for that.
Right. And that's the first year. Eventually, it goes up after 10 years to $400 a month.
Okay.
And then alternative energies become cheaper, and then we'll be charging less tax on the fossil fuels, so it'll go down, the dividend, eventually.
But why, if I'm not really consuming much in the way of carbon, why do I get $48 a month? I would still get $48 a month, yes?
Yes. We all are consuming carbon. You know, a lot of it is hidden in the things we purchase. Whether the item has fossil fuel in it, or whether it had to be transported to Rochester, or you had to keep the company going, there's fossil fuel in everything, really.
All right. So it sounds like, as you've been hearing Carol and Sue say, that this kind of a tax is designed to influence behavior. And it sounds like on the federal side, we might say, okay, well, now the cost for fuel has gone up. I'm going to drive my car less, or drive a traditional gasoline car less. But I'll get that $48 a month, and maybe I will start to invest in different things here. You know, maybe I won't drive as much. Maybe I want to save more money by not driving. But I can use this, I guess. And is that money earmarked in any way, Carol? You have to use it in a certain way? No.
No, you can use it any way you want. And so, you know, like people can use it. Many people have high deductibles for their insurance. They don't go to the doctor. They'll have it for that. That increases the federal bill that we're talking about increases jobs tremendously because the income goes back to us and we spend it. So a lot of areas of our economy will be affected by that.
This sounds similar, and again, this is where you can correct me if I'm interpreting wrong, similar to what I've heard from people like James Hansen.
Yes.
Yes?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, and does it have any political chance at all?
Well, see, I see the New York bill. They seem to think that both sides of the House will pass what they've
the
done.
The state bill.
Yeah, the state bill.
Okay.
But we're dealing with Congress, who is predominantly ruled by the Republicans, and the bill is set up so that it really speaks to Republican values.
That's when James Hansen was here last year, by the way. That's why it came to mind, because he says we have to respect those who currently disagree and reach out to them in their language. Sometimes speak to them in conservative terms. How are we going to save money? How is this going to be good for the economy? Yes?
Yes. And so our proposal doesn't grow the government. It gives the money back to the people. And then it's a very slowly rising tax. So entrepreneurs and other people will be able to get loans to develop more alternative energy. And so things will move on in a slow, methodical way where businesses can plan.
If a federal bill passed, and I think to Carol's point, it's probably not likely with the current congressional makeup, but you never know. If it passed, would that eliminate the need for a state bill on a carbon tax?
Yeah.
Okay.
But, you know, it takes time with the national level.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
But, you know, I don't agree with that it's not likely to pass, because in September, 11 Republican congressional representatives came out and asked that the Congress consider getting a committee together to address climate change. And since then, two more Republican congressional representatives have joined on. So as we get the word out there, people like it and they understand it. It's just nobody's ever heard of it.
Sure. And that's part of what we're doing right here. That's part of what the forum is tonight. It's 7 o'clock tonight at Brighton Town Hall, 7 to 8:30. The League of Women Voters sponsoring the forum on various pieces of legislation designed to impact climate change in various ways. And so let me let the rest of the panel weigh in on what we were just discussing there. Sue, does it matter to you, federal bill, state bill? I guess the state bill, as she said, is a little more pragmatic. You don't want to wait. I guess if you think this is important, you don't want to wait forever for a federal bill. But what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a case for New York leading the way, as we have on a lot of issues over the years. And the state bill, 40% of the money, the revenue from the tax, would be used as a tax offset for the low-income to moderate people. They could declare savings there. And then the 60% of the money, I think, goes to investing in the build-out of the renewable infrastructure. So that is a way that's different from the CCL federal plan. This is creating a fund to do energy efficiency improvements, to invest in the construction of solar and wind facilities. And I believe the state bill has a provision that if federal legislation is given on this issue, that the state bill would go away.
Okay, got it. And so I think it was in this recent campaign, your organization and some local groups, you put together forums for political candidates. You couldn't always get an equally balanced panel despite your best efforts. So, Sue, if you're sitting in a room with a member of Congress who's a Republican or a state lawmaker who is a Republican, and they are presenting some resistance, the kind that you've heard on these issues in the past, what is the language that you think does appeal to people who are conservative?
Well, I think there's a couple different things. One is the issue of actual conservation. There are many Republicans who traditionally have wanted to conserve or protect natural resources. Hunters, fishermen still appeal to those values. Understanding that pollution, carbon pollution, is included in that, in ruining those resources for them now and for in the future. Another is the money, the economic point of view. It is going to continue to cost us more and more money to do nothing. Doing nothing is a choice. Doing nothing is doing what we've always have been doing, and that comes at a cost to us. And the cost of change is ultimately going to be less for us.
Because right now, they will view this as just another tax.
Right. Right. And so that's why Citizens Climate Lobby uses the language of fee and dividend to try to shift away from the idea of a tax.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Barbara Grosh, what do you make of the hopes of these? Mothers Out Front looks at many issues, and when it comes to a state and federal bill on a carbon tax, what do you think?
I think ideally this should be federal legislation. Federal legislation is stalled on so many fronts that we can't sit around waiting for whatever's going to happen to shake that loose. So that's why we're pushing forward at state levels. And I think historically, a lot of environmental work has progressed at the state level far before it's been acceptable at the federal level. I personally have a hard time understanding how it got to be such a partisan issue, because climate change is going to affect everyone. If you've got a mansion on the Outer Banks, it's going to be underwater. You've already had a lot of land loss due to rising sea levels. There's just nothing partisan about.
But this is where I think I do understand where there's a bit of a partisan divide, because I've said on this program many times, and I think it probably bears repeating. I think some of what has politicized climate is that what we do in response to it is heavily debated. Can we do enough? Can we do anything? Can we do it without it hurting us economically? And I know whenever I say that, Sue winces. You know, it just physically is hurts her to hear that. And that's part of the conversation. But I think what has happened is some people who feel like we can't make any real sort of mitigation changes without really hurting us economically, therefore, let's argue that this isn't happening at
all.
You
know what?
But I do think on the policy side,
I want to quote my Republican assemblyman, Mark Johns.
Okay.
I used to talk to him back when fracking was still in play, and he'd say, you know, I'm a conservative Republican, and fracking is not conservative. Fracking is going ahead and ripping up the earth and hoping it'll turn out for the good. That is not a conservative stance. Conservative is you don't take enormous risks. So I think it would be a conservative thing to stop climate change.
Okay. Well, and by the way, I am taking your word for it that Assemblyman Johns said essentially that. But Assemblyman Johns is a frequent listener of the program and a nice guy. And if he's listening today, Mark, call the show. We'd love to hear from you on that. In fact, it's a great time for you to do that, Mark, because we're talking about state and policy, among other things. We're talking about climate change and how to mitigate based on government policy. Can it work? What's out there? What's being proposed? Tonight, there's a free public forum sponsored by the League of Women Voters, Rochester Metro Area, from 7 to 8:30 at Brighton Town Hall. And the people here on the panel today, they're going to be there tonight explaining some of these issues and also answering some questions and sort of giving you a chance to follow up. And you can do that now. You can call the program. I see the phone starting to ring. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Now, some people don't. They do think that this is a political stunt. They don't like what they're hearing. I want to grab a phone call first, and we'll let some of the other voices into the program. And this is James in Shalott. Go ahead, James.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't agree at all with what's going on here. First of all, once again, I've mentioned this before. Before you blame the fossil fuel industry, which is an excuse for the elitist to shut down American industry so they can buy it up for pennies on the dollar, let's take a look at why the chemtrails are in the eastern sky every morning messing with aluminum sulfate in the upper atmosphere. Let's find out about the HAARP project in Alaska, supercharging with magnetism and electricity the upper ionosphere for weather patterns. I don't buy climate change any more than I buy the plausibility of the U.S. Army having the ability to manipulate weather as an experimental weapon.
Now, James,
all climate change is to shut down American industry so George Soros can buy it up, and these folks who sit here and act like they're informed on this are useful idiots for the cause.
All right, so James, stay there for a second. Stay there for a second. What would it take to change your mind on climate? That the climate is changing?
Yeah, well, first of all, what it will take, not one politician right now is campaigning about, you know what, first of all, alternative energies are fine as long as big companies can sell it to you. You see what I'm saying? Alternative energy, solar and wind, is fine as long as conglomerates can control it, okay? First of all, let's address the chemtrails every day from the jets in the eastern sky. We all know when we were kids in the 70s and 80s, those chemtrails weren't there. Now all of a sudden, you can't have a sunny day on a Monday morning without the Eastern Airline traffic blotting out the sun by 10 in the morning.
I appreciate that part, and I think that's probably a whole other hour just to discuss that, because I know people. But I'm still wondering, you know, move beyond chemtrails. I'm just asking you. I mean, I've talked to paleoclimatologists who spend, you know, three, 4 months out of the year.
We're by the people who want to shut down industry, but go ahead.
No, listen. I'm just saying, I've talked to people who have risked their lives going to some of the most inhospitable parts of our planet to actually study ice cores, drilling, look back tens upon hundreds of thousands of years to try to understand what's going on. And, is this one massive conspiracy that I just haven't sniffed out? Maybe. But people like Vas Petrenko, people like really remarkable people who have risked their lives to done this, I don't necessarily think that they are...
Earth patterns, or is it climate change due to fossil fuels, or can we prove it's just not 8,000, 10,000-year cycle Earth patterns?
Right. But the problem is, I guess the problem I have in what you're sort of arguing is, I've had the same questions, and people much smarter than me who have studied this extensively have said there are climatological long-term patterns that can go 10, 15, 20,000 years. But this is created something that is so marked, so different, as to really be pointing to carbon in a way that is not controversial. It's not, you know, a scandal. It's just what we've been doing. And we're not evil. Human beings are not evil. But now that we sort of understand it, it's a question is, what do we do about it? I don't think people are saying we're evil or we should shut down all industry, right? I think it's just understanding the effects that are different.
I disagree with you, Evan. I believe the top one half of 1% in this world that has 50% or 60% of the wealth, they would shove their own grandmother off a plank to the sharks if they could make 2 cents doing it. So, yeah, do I think people at the very top of industry and business in the world are evil? Absolutely.
James,
don't trust them at all.
James, thanks for the phone call. Sue, you're the educator in the room. James, I think, has a real trust issue with what he's hearing today. Well, how do you have that conversation? Can you? I mean, I know you care deeply about this, and I'm not trying to lampoon James. I appreciate his phone call. What do you think, Sue?
I think it is tremendously difficult to convince people if they're not willing to be convinced. You know, how many thousands and thousands of scientists around the planet are looking at different aspects of this and have drawn the same conclusion. If that doesn't sway him, there's not much from that perspective that I can add that will sway James. I am glad he's really excited about the possibility of renewable energy, and I would love someday for James to understand that our reliance on fossil fuels, whether he believes in climate change or not, is causing tremendous health problems for people and for the environment. A lot of suffering that's needless goes on every day as a result of our dependency on this. So if we can both embrace renewable energy, great. He can think whatever he wants about climate change.
And I think it's important to tell someone like James, who took the time to call the program today, and as someone who I think sounds like the kind of guy I'd love to have a beer with, even if we don't agree on everything. But I don't want to be disrespectful, but I do want to say to James, I don't want to sort of relitigate climate science every time we talk about climate policy.
Right.
Because it is just simply a matter of record that this program is not going to do that every time it comes up. I do think we get bogged down with that. I don't mean to be disrespectful to James. I really, really don't. But I trust the scientific community. And I'm a proud skeptic, and I really believe it's important that we do trust the scientific community. Let me grab Bernard at Fairport. Go ahead, Bernard.
Yeah, I'm glad that James called, because I think he illustrates my point. It seems to me that people who want to address this problem and people who want to deny the problem basically have created the situation by making it so complex. So you're going to have a carbon tax to reduce the use of carbon. Wouldn't it be easier to somehow create some kind of public pressure on people? Don't drive SUVs if you can use cars that you consume less gas. So in other words, put it on a level where people live at home and they recycle garbage, they drive their cars efficiently, et cetera, so that each individual, including 3-year-olds, seem to buy into this stuff of, you know, We need to live smart, and we're not going to be forced to live smart by paying taxes. We're going to be encouraged to live smart if we understand the basic problems, we believe the people that are trying to explain it to us, and we're given reasonable actions that we can take to avoid the problem. So carbon taxes is a great idea. I love it. But it's beyond complexity. You can't explain carbon taxes to a three-year-old, but you could say to a three-year-old, don't eat this food because it's a waste and there's too much wrapping and so on and so forth. So could we make this message better by taking it down a level of intellectual and making it much more of a good way to live your life? I'd appreciate your comments on that.
Thank you, Bernard. Maybe that's a useful question there. And Carol Kemp, go ahead.
Yes. Marshall Sanders, the founder of Citizens Climate Lobby, was big into going out and finding out about the environment and educating the public. And he found that the things we can do individually are great, but they weren't going to make a very big impact when at the same time the federal government was giving $80 million in subsidies to the gas and oil industry. So we have to do this in a global way. And, of course, a federal law will help because we're going to have a tariff for countries who don't have a carbon fee. They're going to have to pay it if they bring stuff in. So that levels the playing field, and it encourages other countries to have a carbon fee also.
But Carol, here's what I think Bernard is saying. I think Bernard would say, a three-year-old doesn't know what a tariff is, though. It's the same thing that people have said to me in the last couple of weeks. Why is nobody talking about this LDC, four people pleading guilty? That's a remarkable local story in local politics. And then somebody said to me, well, if this were a sex scandal, everybody would understand it. And I said, yeah, everybody understands what a sex scandal is. If you talk about bid rigging and this contract was given to this person who happened to be a contributor, and then they rigged it through this quasi-governmental agency, all of a sudden, people are falling asleep. And it doesn't have as much staying power as something that's simpler. And I think what Bernard is saying is, if you want to sell a carbon tax, if you want to sell climate policy, it has to be easily digestible, even all the way down to a three-year-old. I know you want to jump in.
Well, I also want to say that it's not either or. So, for example, when Mothers Out Front has a house party, we talk about what can we as individuals do? And a lot of us will sign up for clean power. You can sign up so that RG&E has to supply you from wind power, and a lot of us do that. And once you've done that, you want everyone to do that, and you want your town to do that, and suddenly you find yourself reading legislation and thinking, that's it, that's what we've got to do. So we do work at promoting savings for individuals and making positive voluntary contributions to cutting carbon, because we find that that leads to an interest and an understanding and a willingness to work our brains to figure out what the policy implications are.
And I would also add to Bernard, and I know you want to jump back in there. I understand his goal of the comment there, because I think there's a lot of value in being able to explain things really simply. But I also appreciate when we ask questions that we do want to get wonky in the policy details, and we do want to kind of get into the weeds. It's nice to be able to do that too. So thanks for doing the forum tonight, 7 to 8:30 at the Brighton Town Hall. It's a preview right now, but tonight, Bernard and many others, I hope James and Charlotte go out tonight, talk to them, you know, listen, I think. I think we've got to do both to that point. We've got to get wonky, but we also have to get simple. Sue?
Right, just to simplify a little bit, you know, price communicates information to people. And right now, if you go to the store and you're faced with two different dozen eggs, they look the same to you, but one costs $3.60 and another one costs $1.25. And a lot of people just buy the $1.25 one because it doesn't tell you on there that this has a carbon footprint that may be several times higher than the box that costs $3.60. You know, and so by addressing price, by incorporating a carbon tax, the carbon will pay its true cost to society, and then we don't have to explain it. Then we can go to the store and say, hey, look, the one that's the least expensive is the healthiest one for the planet.
But this goes back to economics in college. Mm-hmm. I mean, we all got to go back and just make sure that we understand price does not equal cost, that something that has a low price might have a long-term cost that's much higher an egg that has $1.25 a dozen mm-hmm. might have a much higher long-term cost than a $3.50 a dozen set of eggs.
Exactly.
But we often just look at the price. I'm late for a break. Let's get a short break in. We're going to come back with our panel. We're going to talk more about the legislative options. And I suspect we're not going to get through everything this hour because the phones are lit up, which just means you've got to be in Brighton tonight. Brighton Town Hall, League of Women Voters. It's a free public forum on climate policy. That's policy and proposals at the state level primarily that are aimed at addressing and mitigating climate change. Short break and more of your phone calls and questions next. Coming up in our second hour, we continue the discussion on climate change by looking at how it's taught in classrooms. A new survey finds that in high schools in particular, it is not taught very effectively. Many teachers lay off the subject for a variety of reasons. Others who do try to teach it don't do it very scientifically accurately. So how can that change? How can we make climate education better in the classroom? That's next hour.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from City Blue Imaging, a commercial printer based in downtown Rochester for more than 85 years, specializing in digital color printing, trade show, and special event printing. CityBlueImaging.com.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Carol Camps here, member of the Citizens Climate Lobby. Sue Hughes Smith, an environmental educator, member of the Rochester People's Climate Coalition. Barbara Grosh, member of the League of Women Voters Rochester Metro Area and Mothers Out Front. And Catherine Smith's here, the first vice president of the League of Women Voters Rochester Metro Area, talking about the free public forum tonight. Okay, so if you are on the phone waiting to jump in, stay there. All I want to do right now is very briefly have Sue and Barbara kind of give a kind of a quick snapshot of the other various pieces of legislation that are out there. And that for, and then for the rest of the hour, listeners, you want to ask about that, we can. I know one of our callers wants to ask about process to getting bills enacted and right now where things stand. So we can do that. And whatever we don't get through in this hour, you can go out in Brighton Town Hall tonight and continue the conversation. So Barbara Grosh, you're going to be talking tonight about a bill relating to financial surety for major facilities, vessels, and railroads. Is that right?
That's right.
And what does it mean?
Okay, so Bakken oil is being shipped by rail. It goes through Monroe County every day of the week. This oil, it comes from the Bakken Shale Formation out in North Dakota. It's full of natural gases, which makes it very explosive. So every time there's a derailment, there's an enormous fire. They figure the blast zone is half a mile on either side of the railroad tracks. You're not safe within half a mile. So what this bill would do would be to require the shippers that are shipping this oil to prove up front that they have the financial resources to bear the cost if there's a catastrophic or when there's a catastrophic accident. The worst accident so far happened in Lac Megantic in Quebec. 47 people were killed. Quarter of the town burned down. And the next day, the railroads declared bankruptcy, and there was no one to sue. So this is protecting New Yorkers from something that has happened repeatedly, these catastrophic accidents, and saying that if you want to roll the dice with our lives and with our property, you've got to prove up front that you've got the financial resources. It's an adaptation of the bill that's used for shipping. This is already the way shipping is regulated in New York State, and just expanding it to include railroads.
Okay, and Sue Hughes Smith is going to be talking about a bill, Assembly Bill, right? 7497. It's a bill to require 100% clean energy by 2030. That's fast, I think.
Mm-hmm.
That's ambitious.
It is ambitious, and it's in line with what the science says we should be doing, especially since, the Paris talks indicated that we should be aiming for 1.5 degrees of warming rather than 2 degrees. We need to be moving much more rapidly than we currently are. So we should be reducing greenhouse gas emissions by at least 7% a year, and we just really haven't done a whole lot so far. In the last... Like a decade ago, New York State had made the goal of achieving 30% renewable energy by 2015, and we're only at 22%. And since we already had the hydroelectric in place, that means we've only grown by about 3%. And we need to be much more aggressive than that. And that's just electricity. Okay, so what we're talking about here is achieving all of our energy needs by renewable sources by 2030. And it's technologically feasible, it's economically feasible, it's politically a challenge.
Is that a euphemism?
It's a euphemism.
Okay. And so let me start working through some of the phone calls, but one more note on kind of following up on our friend James from Charlotte, because I got an email from another listener who essentially said, you know, why do you always trust the science community? Why don't you question their own intentions? I would just say this. That's a fair question, and there are bad apples in every field, and people are human beings, and people make mistakes, and sometimes people have confirmation bias, even people trained to resist it. But let me just give you an example of what is inspiring. And Marielle and Megan Mack will help me figure out. What was the telescope? They discovered, they thought it was evidence of the Big Bang, dust left over from the Big Bang. And this was a big, big scientific announcement a couple of years ago, I think 2014, maybe fall of 2014. And it turned out to be cosmic dust. They did not have what they thought they had. And they had to sort of walk back and say, excuse me, folks. But of course, when the initial announcement was made about, you know, evidence of the Big Bang, I think it was cosmic lensing, Marielle, if I'm remembering correctly. And again, I'm off the top of my head here. But they put themselves out there, and their colleagues immediately start poking holes in this. And that was a bit of an embarrassment. But to me, that's not embarrassing, because that's science. You've got to prove it, and it's got to hold up, and it's got to stand up to rigorous review. And that's what it's about. So I guess to our friends like James, I would just say, trust me. When these kind of announcements are made in various forms about climate, our history, trends, et cetera, there are many people trying to poke holes in it.
Yep.
And it is not just a cabal of thousands. You know, that's the process, and it's a beautiful, sometimes vicious thing, and I love it. So that's all I'm going to say about that. Let me get back to our phones, and sorry guys, let me grab. Oh, Neely in Rochester wants to know just about process here. Go ahead, Neely.
Hi, thank you. Hi, Barbara and Sue. Thank you so much, Evan. I am with Mothers Out Front as well. And I think Sue hit the nail on the head when she said that it is economically and technologically feasible. But what is the roadblock everywhere right now are politicians at all levels, well, decision makers, which includes politicians. And so my question for Sue, for Barbara, and the CCL, the carbon tax, is what is sort of the timeline and concrete plan to move to change the politics, right? To put pressure on these decisions. Like, what is it going to take, and what is the plan to make that happen, to get these bills passed? Because that is what's missing, and I'm just curious to hear what people are doing and sort of the timeline within which we have to actually get this done. Thank you.
All right, Neely, thanks very much. Who wants to start there? Go ahead.
Well, I'm going to pick that one up. So one of the reasons why I'm talking about the petroleum surety bill is that I find it is something that I can get people to talk to me about who might not want to talk to me about climate change. So it affects climate change, but it's also about safety. Monroe County has, you know, the trains come in from the west and they go through Wheatland and Gates, and then they come into the city, and then they go through Fairport, and every part of our community is at risk of exploding because of these trains. And it includes low-income neighborhoods, it includes high-income neighborhoods, it includes Senator Funke's office. He's my senator, and he's on the Senate committee that's bottled up this bill. And, you know, I can go into Fairport Village and talk to all the business owners in that district and say, do you know about these trains? And most of them actually don't. And they might not want to talk to me about climate change, but they might want to talk to me about the fact that those trains explode regularly, and someday they might explode in Fairport. So I think bringing it down to very immediate levels always helps open up the conversation from someone who might not otherwise want to have the conversation.
If I'm a business owner and you said that, though, I'd say, okay, I would never minimize the devastation that has happened elsewhere, but you said they explode regularly. I mean, is that overstating?
About every 2 to 3 months since the original explosion, there's been another explosion. Now, so far, that the first one was the only one in a populated area, but the people who do the rail safety have announced that there's something like 14 derailments per year. And, you know, just statistically, some of them are in urban areas and some of them have oil trains, and pretty soon there's going to be another one. Also, I can't help thinking that these are a terrible security risk. If I were a terrorist, I would think about these trains.
Okay, well,
I'm a little surprised that the people who worry about security aren't talking about
it. So that's some of your messaging on that issue. What about some of the other ones? Sue?
Oh, well, I think Neely's right. You know, we have to have political momentum. And what's encouraging to me is that there are a number of groups and increasingly more individuals who are saying this is an issue that I'm going to vote for. In New York State, there are two statewide coalitions that have formed. One is 100% renewable New York State by 2030, and this bill is a central cohesive force for that. There are about 80 different organizations. The Rochester People's Climate Coalition has signed on as an endorser of this bill and this campaign. The other one is New York Renews, and that's they're developing their platform, and it will also have a legal component to it, because we need to have an actual piece of legislation that says, hey, you have to do this. It can't just be what a governor says would be nice to have happen, but that we're actually legally obligated to do it. So there's a lot of movement in that direction.
Okay.
So, Evan, the question was, what is the process and how do you influence it?
Yep.
And when you view it as this number of people are opposed and this number of people are for, and the opposed all belong to one political party and those that support all belong to one political party, you're not going to move the process. The first thing, I'm going to state the most obvious, you need to vote. You need to vote for a person who represents your viewpoint. And if this is an issue that is very important to you, you recognize it as your health and safety and your child's and your community, then you need to influence your media to cover such issues. If that's a priority for you and you understand the viewpoint that's been presented on this program today, your first obligation, and I use that word very carefully, is to vote for a person who represents your viewpoint on these issues.
And again, Catherine's not telling you how to vote. She's telling you think about what you believe and then vote based on it. Because I think that's right.
And vote. She did say vote.
Well,
there's a lot of people who don't vote.
More of us than that do. Bill in Fairport emails to say, Evan, you asked about what conservatives, what might appeal to conservatives when it comes to climate action. He says, conservatives will like carbon fee and dividend because it's market-based. Government doesn't choose what kind of light bulbs or cars we should buy. It doesn't subsidize one energy over another. It doesn't pick winners and losers. Consumers just go out and shop. Businesses innovate as they wish. The best solutions for transitioning away from fossil fuels would rise based on market forces. That's Bill in Fairport. So that's his thoughts on just some of the language and some of the ideas there. But then again, you got a lot of suspicion. Richard says, climate change and carbon tax, say it all, a new tax. We all know what government will do with that money. So I think that there is some resistance. And then there's people like Dan and Webster who want to weigh in. Go ahead, Dan.
Hi. Three quick points. First one's kind of off to the side. Thank you so much to your panel for actually saying something sensible about conservatism, because sacrificing potable water for any speculative fictional benefit is not conservative. And environmentalism absolutely is conservative. So thank you. I never hear that. People need to realize that. The other two points related to climate change. Not that I agree with James entirely. I certainly don't. But I think he does raise a couple interesting things. I think it's slightly misleading that we talk about the man-made climate change as though it's really all our fault, when it's a small insulated contingent of powerful capitalists that are predominantly responsible for this. But I see it kind of like the issue of concentrated poverty in the city. It's not our fault, but it is our responsibility. We do need to do something. We need to do a lot of things, but we also have to realize who is behind it, and it's not 99% of the people that have existed on the planet. It's a very small group. And then the third thing, I just wanted to say, I've noticed that climate change it kind of seems like it's becoming a sort of catch-all scapegoat. And just one example to illustrate that point is that when the Zika virus first started coming out and gaining a lot of press, I heard it I heard that climate change was a contributing factor, if not like significantly responsible for this Zika virus and microcephaly. But that kind of seems farcical to me, because when you put an insecticide in water to inhibit the development of baby mosquitoes, and then you see human babies with developmental issues, I think it seems kind of clear, like, what toxin might be responsible for that. I don't think it's necessarily climate change that's, you know, making microcephaly a big problem. But, yeah, just it does kind of seem like it's used politically as too much of a scapegoat, which I'm not sure I'm comfortable with.
Dan, thanks for the phone call. And an interesting last comment there, because it will transition into our next hour very well, which is how climate change is taught. And that's our next hour. Will be a different panel talking about education. But I don't know when it comes to Zika, et cetera.
Right.
I don't know. But Sue, do we injure the cause of trying to address climate change by over-prescribing what we think it's doing?
Well, I just think because the science is complicated and we don't do a clear enough job of articulating the connections, it leaves a lot of confusions and makes it easy for people to misunderstand. And the connection with climate change is that in a warming world, the prevalence of mosquitoes increases. And the prevalence of this particular type of mosquitoes is not just a fault of climate change. And so he is correct that it is a more complicated picture of that. But to say that climate change does play a role in increasing the number of vectors that carry disease is a true statement.
So you can't say climate change gave us the Zika virus, but you could say
correct.
Climate change gave it more prominence and more likely to spread and be dangerous. Or at least, if I'm understanding the science, and that is, I don't know if that's a leap, Sue, but you're saying it's a little more complicated than saying climate change did this or didn't do this. You're saying...
Correct. I mean, Zika existed,
right.
And Zika happens to thrive under certain conditions that people create, but... climate change increases the likelihood that there are more mosquitoes in more places.
Yeah, and to Dan's point, I suspect Dan would agree that I try not to roll my eyes every time there's a tornado or a storm and Governor Cuomo wants to immediately bring up climate change. Mm-hmm. Because as Adam Sobel and some of the really smart climatologists in the country who've been on this program have said, sometimes there is an impact, but you can't look at every single storm and know exactly that is climate change or not. And I do feel like we have a governor who tends to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So, Dan, I'm sensitive to the point, and I think it was well
articulated. I think I've heard that described as you should never let a good crisis go past.
Well,
if he can use it to get support for something he's been trying to do for a long time, that's what he's going to do.
an endorsement from Barbara. Okay, well, let me get one more quick phone call. Patrick in Rochester, and we got to keep it moving. Go ahead, Patrick.
Yes. Not to make things difficult, but if this meeting in Brighton tonight were in Flint, Michigan, what about? I'm not mean, but what about the water, you know, on Great Lakes? We have a Great Lake here. What about that? Thanks.
Thanks very much, Patrick. I don't know exactly if this were in Flint, if this would it be any different right now? I mean, I don't know if he's relating these issues.
Well, I think right now Flint is in a crisis because they tried to privatize water and they switched supplier from one thing to the other, and it's contaminating their water from the lead that's in their pipes. We have our own lead issue already here in Rochester, so lead exposure is not something you could drink directly linked to climate change.
There you go.
That's a different public health
right. And as
discussion.
We know, we talked about this a couple Fridays ago in this program, the lead problem in Rochester is, unlike Flint, it's not water-based. Generally, it's paint-based.
Correct.
And that's been an ongoing fight. But
aging pipelines are something we could talk about
climatically
because so many methane pipelines are aging and leaking. And the crisis that's been going on in California for the last 5 or 6 months, leaking massive amounts of methane from old pipes that they knew were leaking, and they just decided they could keep deferring maintenance on.
That's a great point.
All right, so as we've seen this hour, there are a number of pieces of legislation that are out there right now, and you heard from our guests varying levels of optimism about whether they're going anywhere this year. We'll see. But part of the point, I think, for the League of Women Voters is to let the public know that's out there and to give you a chance to have a voice. So Catherine Smith, as we get ready to wrap up here, what do you hope the community gains from a forum like you'll have tonight, 7 to 8:30, free public forum at the Brighton Town Hall?
One, the educational forums we do is strictly to inform people about particular bills and particular issues. So it's for people that have heard of it in a general sort of way and would like more specifics on it. The other thing about forums that we do with the educational, there is a question and answer period. And we do listen to the public.
You take phone calls?
We don't take phone calls. Evan, all the years I've done this, which is many more years than Evan, I couldn't even come close to his skills.
I
just marvel. He. You don't know it when you're listening, but he's doing four things at once, and
Stop.
He's doing them well. Tonight, I will try to do one at a time, but I will be ready for the audience, Evan.
Well,
because it could be a very interesting group of people coming this evening.
I suspect it will. 7 o'clock tonight, Brighton Town Hall, for that forum, sponsored by the League of Women Voters. Thank you, Catherine. Thanks for being here. Sue, Carol, Barbara, thank you for taking the time to explain these various issues to us. No matter where people stand on them, it's good to get good information about the legislation that's out there. So thanks for being here, and thanks for what you're doing tonight. I know a lot of people will see you at Brighton Town Hall.
Thank you, Evan.
Thank you.
Short break, and we're talking teaching climate change. A new survey was not optimistic about how well it's being taught in the classroom. That's next.